I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. I remember being riveted, along with the rest of the country, watching the Supreme Court nomination of Clarence Thomas 25 years ago. For 3 days in 1991, the Senate Judiciary Committee, headed up by then-Senator Joe Biden from Delaware, held the most extraordinary hearings, where Anita Hill testified in graphic detail that Clarence Thomas had sexually harassed her when she worked for him. Thomas was confirmed by a vote of 52-48 after Hill was grilled, and Thomas compared the hearings to a high-tech lynching. HBO recreated that event in their movie The Confirmation, starring Kerry Washington and Wendell Pierce, that aired last Saturday night. We asked Tobias Barrington Wolf to join us. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He writes and teaches in the fields of civil procedure, complex litigation, and constitutional law. He's also done extensive work as an advocate and civil rights lawyer on the issue of LGBT equality. And Tobias, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And I should add, joining us by Skype. Take us back 25 years. I certainly remember those 3 days. I think I was probably a little bit older than you. How old were you, Tobias, back then?
I was a senior in college. I was 21 years old when the hearings happened.
And what was your reaction?
Well, on a personal level, it was actually a very powerful event for me. Those hearings are one of the primary reasons that I wound up going to law school.
Because?
Well, watching Professor Hill testify, for me, it taught me something about humanity that I didn't know I had to learn. I must say, both Judge Thomas and Professor Hill were extraordinarily compelling for very different reasons in their testimony. And in the case of Professor Hill, she modeled a kind of integrity and a willingness to be both strong and vulnerable in service of the truth that I don't think I had ever seen before. And it remains for me one of the sharpest examples of that kind of human virtue that I've ever seen. And it was coupled, of course, with a larger context that had to do with justice, that had to do with both justice for her as an individual and larger issues of justice surrounding the momentous occasion of a Supreme Court nomination. And I was so appalled at the treatment that she received by the Senate Judiciary Committee and distressed that she was greeted with such aggressive skepticism, both on that committee but also in the court of public opinion, that it really activated for me a sense of the combination of justice and human virtue, which I think had a lot to do with why I went to law school.
Well, let me play. We do want to play several clips. Let me play the first one, and this is during this 1991 hearing. Anita Hill is testifying about some interactions she had with Clarence Thomas, including discussions about pornography. Now, this has been played many times, and I should just add it's graphic and probably not appropriate for young children to listen to, but let's us listen to it.
His conversations were very vivid. He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes. He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises or large breasts involved in various sex acts. On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess. Because I was extremely uncomfortable talking about sex with him at all, and particularly in such a graphic way, I told him that I did not want to talk about these subjects.
And again, that was from the 1991 Supreme Court nomination hearings for Clarence Thomas. And of course, the voice of Anita Hill as she testified at the hearing. I've interviewed Anita Hill, and she's a very careful talker. She certainly was very composed, very unemotional at this committee hearing. And at the same time, we hear this graphic testimony. Tobias, I would assume kind of almost unheard of at a confirmation hearing for someone for the Supreme Court.
Well, that is certainly true. And I actually would offer a different description of her testimony. I don't think that she was unemotional. Actually, I think that she demonstrated deep emotion. She presented it in a very contained and careful fashion. But part of what she allowed the committee and therefore the world to see was the pain and the humiliation that she had experienced as a result of this harassing behavior. And part of what she described and the larger meaning of Professor Hill's testimony is often described in terms of America's understanding of sexual harassment, which was very young as a legal doctrine, right. It should be said, at the time that Professor Hill testified. She explained in very cogent terms that she experienced this harassment as being about power, as being about the exercise of power and control over her in this very vulnerable setting. And she allowed the impact of that disempowering and humiliating behavior, she allowed people to witness that. She allowed people to understand it through her description. And I think it was a very emotionally wrenching experience watching her testify. It's simply that she presented these emotions in a way which was careful and controlled rather than sort of lashing out in the way that perhaps another person might have.
Yeah, and those are all, I think, very important points. And I think it should also be said that she was a reluctant witness. She was tracked down, almost in a sense outed in her testimony. She there was a member of, I believe it was Senator Kennedy's office who found her and had, in a sense, promised her some degree of privacy or anonymity on this. But, of course, that didn't happen.
That's right. So in early September of 1991, then Judge Thomas was nominated by President George H.W. Bush in July of 1991. And in early September, Professor Hill was contacted. She was a member of the University of Oklahoma Law School faculty at the time. She has since moved to Brandeis University. And she was contacted by a Senate Judiciary staffer, or rather a staffer for a member of a senator who was a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I think you're right that it was Ted Kennedy.
I think so.
And that staffer asked her a series of questions about sexual harassment within the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which was the agency that Judge Thomas headed, the second of two agencies where Professor Hill worked for him. And she at first was not willing to talk about it and said she would not confirm or deny any of what she was being asked about. And she ultimately decided upon further questioning from Senate Judiciary staffers to provide them with a statement and to speak to a pair of FBI agents on the condition that her statement simply be provided on a confidential basis to the committee, shown to the nominee so that he and his counsel could have a chance to respond to it and the committee could make of it what they would in their deliberations. And then later in September, her statement in its entirety was leaked by someone, I don't know whether we know who, to the press. And at that point, it became clear both that she needed to have some assistance in responding to this press attention, and also the Senate Judiciary Committee decided that they would hold an open session hearing.
Well, let me play another clip from the hearing. This is Clarence Thomas defending himself and responding to some of the charges from Anita Hill. Let's give this a listen.
I think that this today is a travesty. It's a national disgrace. And from my standpoint, as a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you. You will be lynched, destroyed, caricatured by a committee of the U.S. Senate rather than hung from a tree.
And again, Clarence Thomas, his famous defense almost 25 years ago in the fall of 1991 before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And Tobias, so much going on there. One, of course, is his use of language. As you said, this was really about power in so many ways. What do you hear in his response to these charges?
Well, this is probably one of the most discussed, if not the most discussed, passage of this entire set of hearings. And one of the things that I find extraordinary, and as I said at the outset, I think both Professor Hill and Judge Thomas were astounding witnesses. And in the case of Judge Thomas, he seized control of the room. And I think there was real doubt about whether the nomination was going to go forward. And I think his testimony saved his nomination for him. And I think it saved his nomination for him because he succeeded in maintaining a demeanor of unqualified outrage, which I think is a very difficult thing to do, whatever the underlying reality is. I think that's just psychically, emotionally a difficult thing to do. But also, he did something very subtle, and that passage exemplifies it. Judge Thomas had genuine sources of anger and grievance at the treatment that he had received during the course of his career because he was a successful, smart, ambitious, hardworking African-American man whose political views and whose substantive legal views didn't conform with what a lot of people expected of successful African-American men. He was not a left-wing or liberal or civil rights advocate in the traditional sense. And he spent, I think, a lot of his career being told that he was somehow ungenuine or less than because he didn't have the right set of views. And what I hear him doing in that passage, I mean, I'll be clear to say, I believe Anita Hill's testimony. And so take that as as one way of understanding what I'm about to say. But I think that Judge Thomas drew upon some real and genuine and legitimate sources of anger and grievance and wrapped them in a language which was to this committee of white men an unanswerable language, invoking the history of lynching and the history of Jim Crow segregation by a man who grew up in a poor town in the Jim Crow segregated South. And he was able to combine a core of truth with a repudiation of these allegations in a way which I think the committee just found unanswerable.
Well, I want to pick up on that. Tobias, we just have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are rolling the clock back almost 25 years to the Supreme Court nomination hearings of Clarence Thomas in the fall of 1991. And Tobias Barrington-Wolf is our guest, professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Much more after this short break. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking about what happened then 25 years ago and how we think about it now. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Tobias Barrington-Wolf. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. We are talking about events that happened just about 25 years ago, the Supreme Court nomination hearings of Clarence Thomas. One of the reasons we're doing it is HBO actually recreated those events in their movie, The Confirmation. It aired Saturday night on HBO, starring Kerry Washington and Wendell Pierce. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Tobias, just picking up on a couple of things that both Clarence Thomas said and you said about him, and also underscoring the fact that the members of the Judiciary Committee were all white men, and you've got a black nominee for the Supreme Court and a black woman who is accusing him of all sorts of sexual harassment. So the racial complexity, I guess, is certainly very much on display. And I mean, could it be said that Clarence Thomas was playing the race card by talking about high-tech lynching?
Well, that's certainly one of the ways that people often describe that testimony. And the identity of Professor Hill as not just a woman, but an African-American woman. And the history of sexual violence against African-American women in the United States, that was a perspective that was largely lost, or at least not discussed in relation to these events. Judge Thomas invoked very powerfully his identity as a black man, and you know, the most extreme imagery that one could invoke in talking about the history of lynching in the United States. I mean, what the irony here is, of course, that lynching was a practice that was a tool, an aggressive tool of social control. It involved the vicious murder and often dismemberment of specific individuals, but it also involved a tool for controlling entire populations of people.
I mean, it's terrorism. And lynching was terrorism.
It was domestic terrorism. Right. I mean, the United States, for much of its history, was a white supremacist nation, and used terroristic tactics to keep African Americans under control. And I don't mean to draw any kind of equivalence between the practice of lynching and the practice of sexual harassment. That would not be appropriate.
Right.
But they are both tools for instantiating discrimination and exercising control. And part of what he did by invoking that imagery was to shift the focus from Professor Hill's, you know, very responsible and careful description of the ways in which his harassment had been a tool of controlling her in the workplace, and to sort of appropriate that idea and to invoke the most extreme form of violent social control that we had ever seen in the African-American experience in the United States, other than slavery itself.
Hmm.
And it was an astoundingly effective device, whether one admires it or whether one finds it reprehensible. It was an astoundingly effective device.
And thereby, what, taking control of the hearings themselves?
To be sure. Yeah, I think that, I mean, if you watch the testimony of Professor Hill in its entirety, I watched it in its entirety when I was in college, and I actually did so again in preparation for our discussion today. There's a lot to say. Among other things, Senator Kennedy was almost a non-presence on the committee.
I remember that.
And there's much speculation that the reason was that the complexities of his own personal life, and including his having been responsible for the death of Mary Jo Kopechne in the Chappaquiddick incident, just led him to believe that he couldn't effectively engage on the details of this sexual harassment issue. And in fact, there was one occasion towards the end of Professor Hill's testimony when Ted Kennedy rebuked Arlen Specter, who was the chief sort of prosecutor for the Republicans on the committee, for mischaracterizing something that Professor Hill had said. And Senator Specter jumped back in and very sharply said to Senator Kennedy, I take great exception to that. And if you have something to say, why don't you participate in this hearing more actively?
Wow.
And Senator Kennedy quieted down. And it was clear, I think, to the members of the committee that Senator Kennedy was just did not feel able to participate. And in the case of Judge Thomas's testimony, there was one very arresting moment. Judge Thomas had given an initial response to the statement that Professor Hill provided. She testified, and she went into greater detail in her testimony. And then he came back to testify in response, and that's when he gave this high-tech lynching testimony. And Senator Hal Heflin from Alabama, a very conservative Southern Democrat from Alabama, started questioning Judge Thomas about Professor Hill's testimony, and his response was, "I didn't watch it." And Senator Heflin said, "I'm a little unsure how to proceed here. You know, you're here to respond to her testimony. I want to ask you about it." And he says, "I didn't watch it. My only response is a categorical response. It's all a pack of lies, and I have nothing else to say about the details." That was an astoundingly bold thing for him to do. And it was very effective, but it was effective because the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee were not prepared to go after him in the way that I think they certainly would have gone after Professor Hill Had she declined to offer details and simply said, I've chosen not to review what you think is relevant material because I have what I have to say and that's all I'm going to say. It's quite extraordinary.
Well, I do want to play, this is a series of clips that we edited together, again from the 1991 hearings. This is Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter interrogating, I'm not sure, the certainly questioning in a very direct and hard manner, Anita Hill about her accusations regarding Clarence Thomas.
Professor Hill, you said that you took it to mean that Judge Thomas wanted to have sex with you, but in fact, he never did ask you to have sex, correct?
No, he did not ask me to have sex. He did continually pressure me to go out with him, continually, and he would not accept my explanation as one as being valid.
You are not now drawing a conclusion that Judge Thomas sexually harassed you.
Yes, I am drawing that conclusion. That
well,
is
then
my...
I don't understand.
Pardon me?
Then I don't understand. The fact is, flatly, he never asked you to look at pornographic movies with him.
With him? No, he did not.
And again, this some of the testimony from 1991. Tobias, going back to you, and, you know, one wonders in 2016 how Anita Hill would have been questioned if this were happening today.
Indeed. And I must say, I think it is a stain on Senator Specter's legacy, the way that he comported himself in that hearing. And let me say exactly why I say that. You know, he was an aggressive questioner, and I don't think that's inherently objectionable at all. But what he did was to take every source of aggressive skepticism and resistance to the idea of sexual harassment and to take every kind of excuse that is offered to refuse to believe people, particularly women, who come forward explaining that they've been sexually harassed. And he wrapped it up in the demeanor of an aggressive interrogator, meaning that he adopted this posture of sort of deliberate confusion. One of the tactics, he used to be the district attorney of Philadelphia. He was an accomplished lawyer. And, you know, in response to one of the most cogent and clear witnesses one could have asked for, he constantly treated Professor Hill's testimony as though it were incomprehensible, as though the things that she was saying just didn't make sense. And one of the big issues that he harped on and that many of the other members of the committee harped on was the question of why she followed Judge Thomas from the position of Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights in the Education Department, where they began together and where the harassment started, to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, where the harassment continued. And Professor Hill gave, you know, very powerful testimony to the effect that she was a 24, 25-year-old young lawyer. She was concerned about her professional prospects. She felt disempowered. She was trying to take what steps she could to gain back some kind of control over the situation, to not have her professional prospects limited by his misbehavior, and to be able to pursue a professional opportunity that she found fulfilling, without having the answer to his harassment have to be that she had to leave the office and go find another job. And really, Senator Specter and his colleagues just refused to even acknowledge that that is the dilemma that women who experience sexual harassment face. And I know that for years afterwards, Senator Specter faced a lot of questions and a lot of disapproval about the way he comported himself in that hearing.
And it should be added that Clarence Thomas obviously has been sitting on the court for just about 25 years now. So he was confirmed 58 to 48. And shortly after these hearings, it looks like both the press and also, I believe, the public supported Clarence Thomas. New York Times reporting 58% believed Thomas, 24% believed Hill. I don't know if things have changed over the passage of time, 25 years later. Do you see that we have learned something about sexual harassment in the last 25 years?
Gosh, that's a tough question. I mean, one of the things we haven't talked about yet is that there were four witnesses who came forward in support of Professor Hill, three of them people whom she had spoken to about the harassment contemporaneously when it was happening, two friends of hers in Washington and a man who was a friend and whom she dated for some time. And then the fourth was a law professor colleague whom she met 5 years later and just had occasion to mention this 5 years later, but still 4 years before the hearings happened. And both within the Senate Judiciary Committee and in a lot of the reporting, this was described as a he said, she said situation, that horrible phrase. And her charges is the wrong word, but her description of his conduct was described as unsubstantiated. And I think what people mean by unsubstantiated is that there was not another person present witnessing his misconduct when he engaged in it. But she had four contemporaneous witnesses explaining that she described this behavior at the time. She was not seeking to take any action for it. She was really just upset by it, and there were occasions when she needed to talk about it. And that, I think, is as much a problem today as it was 25 years ago, that you know, there is a tendency to frame... I mean, yes, I think we have made advances in some mm-hmm. important ways mm-hmm. in the expectations that people have about equal opportunity in the workplace. But when you get down to particular cases, I think that both men and women, but disproportionately women, face some of the very same types of responses and some of the very same types of obstacles that Professor Hill encountered in this hearing.
She wrote a memoir, and she's written, although she hasn't sought a lot of the limelight on this, one thing that I circled that she wrote, she said those members of Congress had never even considered that black women had our own political voice. They assumed that black men spoke for us. For an African-American woman to have her own political voice and own political position and to believe that our perspective should be added to the conversation was just something they had not even considered.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
That's right. And, you know, one of the lead members of Professor Hill's legal team was a professor at Harvard Law School named Charles Ogletree. Professor Ogletree is a friend of mine and himself a great and important figure in the legal intellectual world. And he has talked about his reasons for joining Professor Hill's legal team. And one of the things that he said was, at the time of her testimony and at the time of these public events, there was a voice missing in support of her, and that missing voice was the voice of black men. And that to a significant extent, Professor Hill encountered either silence or even a very hostile reaction from black men who, I'm sure had a variety of reasons for reacting to her the way that they did. And Professor Ogletree has said, as a black man myself, I felt the need, he has said, to contribute my efforts because I saw a voice missing and I wanted to make sure that voice was a part of her legal team.
He filled the seat that had been occupied by Thurgood Marshall, a civil rights icon. Marshall himself said that this is not the black position on the Supreme Court, that this is just someone who should be qualified and be able to serve on the court. As you look at Clarence Thomas's rulings, and he does not talk a lot from the bench, what do you make of how he sees our legal system, how he sees the job of a Supreme Court justice?
Well, I'll say a couple of things about that, and it's useful to start with the comparison to Justice Marshall. One of the, I think, consistently unfortunate and indeed quite reprehensible responses that Justice Thomas has encountered on the court during his time on the court is a kind of racist dismissal by liberals that recapitulates in a lot of ways the racist dismissal of Justice Marshall by conservatives during his tenure on the court. I have a friend and colleague named Angela Onwuachi-Willig, who's a professor at University of Iowa Law School, and she's done some of the most important work in tracing this out. A lot of the language that people use to dismiss Justice Marshall, that he was not an independent thinker, that he was sort of a cipher who did whatever Justice Brennan did, the great liberal lion of the court when he was on the court, that he relied very heavily upon his law clerks. You see the same language deployed in describing Justice Thomas by liberals. And it was in many ways quite inaccurate with respect to Justice Marshall, and it in many ways is quite inaccurate with respect to Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas is I think it's safe to say, the single most independent, jurisprudentially, the most independent member of the court. I happen to disagree with almost all of what he writes on the court, I will say quite frankly. But it's both a case as a quantitative matter that he did not vote with Justice Scalia excessively much, which is the description which is often tossed out about him. The correlation between his voting and Justice Scalia's, which is much lower than that of some of the other conservatives. But also that his actual writings on the court, he's an iconoclast. He has a view about the interpretation of the Constitution, which is in many respects a very textualist and originalist view, is I think how he would describe it. But it's one that takes an aggressively skeptical view about the change of circumstances over time and the relevance of those changed circumstances to the interpretation of the Constitution. And there's nobody on the court who is more willing to jettison settled precedent and to simply wipe the slate clean and start over in major, major areas of the law if he has disagreements with them than Justice Thomas. I think Justice Thomas has a lower regard for stare decisis and precedent than anybody else on the court. And whether one views that as a good thing or a bad thing, it sets him apart. It makes him quite jurisprudentially independent. And so his legacy is a distinctive one, and not the sort of caricature that it's often portrayed as.
Tobias Barrington, well, thank you so much, as always, for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, joining us by Skype, talking about the confirmation hearings of 25 years ago of Clarence Thomas for the U.S. Supreme Court. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Earlier this month, we took Radio Times on the road to Reading Terminal Market to tell the story of how Philly became a foodie destination with four guests. Aliza Green played a big role in Philly's restaurant renaissance. She's a caterer, cooks at Baba Olga's Kitchen at Material Culture. Her 15th cookbook is Magic of Spice Blends. Kevin Parker is the owner of Miss Tootsie's on South Street, the soul food cafe at Reading Terminal Market, and Simply Delicious Caterers. Michael Pasquarello and his wife Jennifer are owners of 13th Street Kitchens, and that includes Cafe Lift, Prohibition Tap Room, Buffad Pizza, Kensington Quarters, and Buckminster's Bistro. Ellen Yin is founder and co-owner of High Street Hospitality Group, and that operates Fork and High Street on Market in Philadelphia and High Street on Hudson in Manhattan. Let's listen to some highlights.
So let me throw this out to everybody, but I'll put this first to you, Ellen Yin, which is, There's New Orleans, there's San Francisco, there's New York, there's certainly other cities in this country that could be described as foodie towns. What makes this place special, unique, different?
That's a great question, because I think over the past year, people throughout the country are acknowledging Philadelphia as a food city, not an up-and-coming food city, but as a food city. And I think it has to do, you know, partly with the people who are in the industry. So there is a sense of collaboration, not as much a competitive feeling. And I also think that it has to do with the fabric of the city. I mean, all the different neighborhoods here. Philadelphia has an amazing upper-level restaurant tier, but it also has a great restaurant community in the ethnic neighborhoods, as well as in, you know, a lot of accessible dining.
How about for you, Kevin? What's your experience of Philly?
I believe that I've seen how Philadelphia has grown in the restaurant industry. I've been doing it for 21 years. The thing that I'm most inspired and excited about is that it's so eclectic, and that it gives people the opportunity to try different cuisines that they probably would have never tried before. So I actually see people venture into different style restaurants that they probably would have never done 10, 15 years ago. So it's just, for me, it's exciting to see so many restaurants come on board and so many people come on with different concepts. and different ideas on doing food.
And I'll pick up on all of that. Isn't it great, all the noises that are happening around this year? Just need to acknowledge that. How about for you, Michael? How do you see it?
I see it as a bit of a... I think there's been a little bit of a graduation moment where a lot of the young cooks or young people that were flourishing under people like Ellen or other restaurants in the city, learning great things from those kinds of folks, graduated and opened up their own really small places. So back to echo that there's, it's not just a bunch of Italian or French places. There's a lot of ethnicity. People are picking up what they've learned working in the industry. And So the pool of great restaurants has just grown to huge. I feel like it's always been a lot of restaurants, but now there's like a lot of really great restaurants, you know. So,
do you think, I mean, people, everyone's a critic now, as we all know. I wonder how that's changed people coming to eat at a restaurant or your restaurant. People have high standards. I think people know more about food than they did a generation ago, and maybe come with bigger expectations.
People are definitely much more sophisticated, and their expectations are definitely much higher, which means that as a restaurateur, you have to make sure that you have a great value proposition. I mean, your food can be awesome, but if people don't want to pay it, it doesn't make any difference. So, you know, we get criticisms on the internet all the time about, you know, ambiance, about, you know, sound, about the quality of the food, about, you know, anything, whether the server didn't look at them or, you know...
Or did look at them.
And, you know, the only thing I would say about, you know, online interviews or online reviews would be that, you know, as a restaurateur, I would want to know that before the guest leaves. And that's my only thing. But I do read them. I try not to go crazy because you can really...
Just because you want to know what that dining experience was, even if it doesn't...
I tell all my staff that I don't want to read them and that I absolutely refuse to read them. But then I, like, in 4 weeks, I'll be like, oh, my God, I have to find out what people are saying.
And then you regret having...
It's helpful information. Right. You just have to keep it in check because it's a very personal business. I mean, you know, whatever you're doing, you know, it's an extension of yourself to a large degree.
Because it is so personal. How about for you, Kevin? I mean, do you check Yelp and see what people are saying?
It's so crazy that you just said that because we... And when I say we, my entire team, every week in my leadership meeting, we go over the Yelp reviews to say, yeah, we go over every review. And we discuss it and we talk about it. However, what I've learned to do over these past years is I've learned how to digest and ingest what I feel is really important. And then I've learned how to actually not even allow certain things to penetrate me because what I find is that it will literally drive you crazy. But if you see a common thread, and the common thread perhaps is service, then that means that you definitely need to focus on service. But if you see something where someone's talking about the music is too loud on a Friday night and it's happy hour, then to me that's kind of like something I'm not going to focus on as much as I would focus on service. But I remember it was a time where literally I wouldn't go to sleep. I was just so overwhelmed by the negative reviews, and every negative review, it really becomes personal. This is something that you birth. It's like your child. You birth this restaurant. Some things you have to just let roll off. In this business, you definitely have to have thick skin.
Yeah. How about for you, Michael? I mean, do you obsessively read the reviews as we're hearing?
No. I mean, I think to all the points up here, you want to entertain them. I mean, ultimately, we're in the service industry, and, you know, what the people are saying about your place, what they actually want from you is your livelihood, so you better pay attention or else sort of situation. I think we can all hate on Yelp all we want, but yes. It's been slightly helpful, I think.
Aliza, I'm talking about reviews or
and
critics.
It's not as relevant to me because it's basically what we're doing these days is catering. We did have a cafe running for a couple of years, and then the reviews were more significant. I do think that people can be really mean when they're, like, it's kind of anonymous. I think that especially for startups, like a new place opening, when there's always going to be the rough stuff to figure out, and come on, cut me a break. Right. Let us try and work this stuff out. But also, I think that it's a detriment for independent restaurants. You know, we are constantly fighting against the chains taking over. I don't know what the statistics are right now, but the large chains are stronger and stronger all the time. Well, they have the budgets, the experience, the team that goes in and opens up another one of these, whatever it is, they've done it over and over again, they know how to do it. People that are just getting into it, you know, you had to figure it out.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just need a little bit of slack. I mean, not that you don't want to be good, but, you know, give me a chance to get good.
There's so many different trends. I mean, there's the farm to table. I know you were part of the early part of that, Aliza. It seems like it's still with us. There's the kind of snout to tail, or is it tail to snout? I never know. You're part of that, Michael, right?
Call it what you want.
I call it. Well, what do you call it?
Well, we call it whole animal, just... We call it food. We've been like applauded for doing this like nouveau concept, I guess, but it's actually very old world. I mean, mm-hmm. having a butcher in a restaurant is actually older than having just a restaurant without a butcher. So I think that it's been an amazing thing. So yes, I mean, we call it whole animal. It's just, we're dealing with the whole animal. It's a whole nother heap of challenges.
I was reading one of your items on the menu is a fried bologna sandwich.
At Buckminster.
A fried bologna sandwich?
Sure, well, come on. Well, so it's a quick funny story about the fried bologna sandwich. We were opening a restaurant bar in Point Breeze, and every chef in the city, they don't want to make sandwiches anymore. And so Rob Marzinski, our chef there, I was like, you know, I think we really ought to have a sandwich on the menu. And we back and forth about it. And he's amazing. And one of the things he said, okay, if we're going to do it, you know, we're going to make the bread and we'll do it this way. And I showed up to taste it one day, and they're all standing around, all these chefs around the table, and they put an egg on top of the sandwich and give you a steak knife and a fork. And it was like, so if we're going to make a sandwich, we're going to make you cut it with a fork and a knife to eat it. But anyhow, it's delicious, and they serve it without the egg if you want to eat it like that. But it's just a whole other conversation is about chefs not really wanting to cook sandwiches anymore, in my experiences, in my places.
I'm curious about how you add to your repertoire, Kevin. I'll put it to you in terms of just looking at a menu and your own, perhaps, explorations, eating things, how you want to expand the cuisine at your restaurants. Well, I mean, there's some staples, I'm assuming, and then you want to build from that.
Yeah, I think you definitely have the staples, especially, I mean, we're a Southern-style restaurant. However, what I've found to be so true is that, you know, perhaps 20 years ago, you had a different diner. You know, now, 20 years later, you have a completely different guest that's coming into your restaurant. So what I try to do is I always try to research, and I talk to my chefs about what's new and what's different, and still things that still have a Southern flair, because I never want to go away from what our foundation is, which is Southern-style food. But what I try to do and what we have been doing is we've been adding things to our menu. So I think that what happens is you have to broaden your menu perspective, and you have to make sure that you still keep the foundation of what you're doing, but you have to realize that the guest that you had when you maybe opened, like I opened 20 years ago, that guest is no longer the same guest today. And when I say that, it may be the same guest, but now that their experiences have been so much broader because they've gone so many places, because maybe 20 years ago in Center City you had 50 restaurants, and now today you have 300 restaurants. So people are actually venturing out and trying different things that they would have never tried before. I get a lot of people now that come and they want to know if we have anything that's vegan. So we've been looking into that. You know, a lot of people definitely talk about the gluten-free. So you have to make sure that you still keep your finger on the pulse, because you just don't want to get left behind and get so caught up in tradition that you don't have the mindset to broaden some of the things that you're serving people.
Do you have vegans that come to your whole animal restaurants?
I think one of the early hurdles was a couple things. Saying that it's a restaurant that's centered around sustainability, and that has a lot to do with what's coming out of the ground also. And, you know, that just circle of life, like, thought process. But also to tell people that it's not just a steakhouse, right? Everybody sort of expected, oh, well, if there's whole animals, whole beef, like, they're going to have steak on the menu. And in a weird way, it's kind of impossible to menu steak in a whole animal movement. You know, we like to we reserve that for the butcher counter. We hold those steaks for one special meal a night, you know, a week. But to back to the vegetarian conversation, that was definitely something that we like to promote ourselves and tell people we're sourcing in the same. We have the same sourcing practices when it comes to, you know, seasonal ingredients, you know, locally sourced. And the harvest is just as exciting as what's available, almost, maybe more, you know.
We have a question over here. Yes, sir.
Hi. Hi there. Thanks for doing this tonight.
Sure.
What's the thought process when you decide to go from one restaurant to multiple restaurants, and what are the different skills that you need for expansion versus running one restaurant?
Are you thinking of doing that?
No.
No. Okay. How about to you, Elenian?
Well, you know, as an entrepreneur, it's kind of in your blood. You can't stop. I don't know how to explain it, but even when I first opened Fork, people were approaching me and asking me about opening another restaurant. And, we looked at different opportunities, but the timing either wasn't right or, whatever. We ended up expanding to Fork, et cetera, the restaurant next door. And that was so difficult. I mean, that was 7 years into Fork being open, and you'd think that, it would be a little bit easier. But even then, Fork, et cetera, was, crazy. The day that, first of all, we didn't have a rat in front, but close to having a rat in front. And, the day after we opened, there was a dumpster in front of the restaurant, so nobody could see that it was open, and it was extremely difficult. And, it takes a different mentality to operate one versus several, and, I've had to change myself, which, is
not easy.
Not easy.
Yeah. Kevin, you want to answer it?
I just want to tag on to Ellen. I think it's all about timing. It's about timing. It's about chemistry, especially with the team that you have. Because if you move at the wrong time, and every opportunity and everything that comes to you is just not always for you. You really, really have to know what's for you and what you can maximize. Because a lot of times you will get approached about doing different things. You just have to make sure that you can actually do it at a level of excellence. And if not, then a lot of times you just have to pass.
We have one more question. Yes, go ahead.
Being in a city with a social divide and a cultural divide, have you been given opportunity, have you found opportunity for your restaurants to go back and to share nutritional health with community members or that more of the impoverished neighborhoods in Philadelphia?
Thanks for the question, yeah. Do you want to take that, Michael?
I think that we experienced this when we were opening up in Buckminster's in Point Breeze, that we really made sure that we were in a community and that we were putting something back there that appealed to a community as a whole. I had heard some stories about the housing things that were happening over there, how, this whole movement was happening where people were being bought, their homes were being bought out from under them, and things were being put back in the place, maybe multi-unit buildings, but things weren't being made affordable for people to stay there. And so the only thing we could do as food people is make sure that we approach, that culinary landscape in a way that appeals to, the demographic as a whole, not just, not just the necessary gentrification that's happening there. So, we really did think about all those aspects there. And I think more and more that's happening.
Well, we are going to end our discussion on that note. My thanks to all four of our guests here for sharing some of their experiences. Thank you for coming out, your support of WHYY. And also a special thanks to Reading Terminal Market for magically turning this place into a beautiful venue. So thank you to them as well.
Yes, thanks to Lisa Green, Ellen Yin, Kevin Parker, and Michael Pasquarello for being our guests. And thanks to WHYY's Brittany Smith, Ellen Steele, and Maggie Layden for their assistance on this members' event. Our engineers were Joyce Lieberman, Kevin Griffin, Frank Felker, and Charlie Kyer. John Ahrens produces Radio Times on the Road. He edited the show. I'm Marty Moscowain, and here is Billy Joel.
A bottle of white, a bottle of red, perhaps a bottle of rosé instead. Get a table near the street in our old familiar place, you and I face.